From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, what will the city of the future look like? WUWM's Chuck Quirnbach talks with the president of the Congress for the New Urbanism. Then proposed changes to the federal food stamp program known as SNAP could impact 25,000 Wisconsin households and hurt local businesses.
SNAP is a critical part of our local economy. It keeps the grocery store industry in business. It employs lots of people. There's a huge benefit to the SNAP program on an economic level.
And Doors Open Milwaukee will have more than 170 buildings open to the public this weekend, but the spotlight this year is on the Near West Side.
If you took away this slice of the city of Milwaukee, you take away a significant chunk of what Milwaukee is.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. It's great to have you with us. I'm Bonnie North. What will the city of the future look like? Will it look like George Jetson or Blade Runner? Well, for the Congress for the New Urbanism, it's much less complex. The city of the future is a city with walkable, vibrant, and prosperous neighborhoods. The national group has members that include architects, urban planners, and developers, all working toward that goal of vibrant and prosperous. Former Milwaukee Mayor John Norquist headed the Congress for about a decade, beginning in 2004. Lynn Richards is his successor as the group's president and CEO. Richards was in Milwaukee recently to speak to the Milwaukee Rotary Club. She also sat down with WUWM's innovation reporter Chuck Quirnbach, who asked her why some people are leaving the suburbs or choosing not to go there at all and instead are living downtown.
Cities are cool again. Cities are cool again for a number of different reasons. You have the aging demographic that is tired of mowing the lawn and the care and feeding of a single-family detached home and wants to downsize into a more urban area where there's more amenities, libraries, museums, art events, etc. Then you have the millennial generation that is much more interested in what's called the creative place or this sense of place. Back in the day when I graduated from college, it was where can I get a job. Folks now getting out of schools, where do I want to live? And then I'll look for a job in that place. And Generation Z, that group that is following very much within the millennials, is they are interested in investing in place. So for example, Gen Z, there's only 24% of the 16-year-olds have learning permits versus in the 1980s, like 52%.
What is a type of place in an urban area they want to experience, and how do they want to experience that?
Well, I wouldn't say how people want to experience place is just limited to a single demographic. I think everybody wants to experience place. So, for example, you have all different demographics traveling to places either on vacation or on the weekends or in the evenings to go to that cool, hip block where you have a lot of restaurants. Oh, did you go here? No one talks to their friends about that cool, like, traffic jam that they were in, right? No one talks to their friends about the amazing experience they had going to the enclosed mall. Think of yourself, to everybody who's listening here, regardless of your age. What do you talk to friends about when you've had a cool experience? It's about getting out and experiencing not only the event, the museum, the coffee shop, the restaurant, the park. It's also about that experience that wraps around it. So the new urbanism is absolutely about how the form of the building meets with the streets and how the buildings and streets are designed, built, and created. But it's also about that intersection of how people experience that place.
Getting to this place, if you live outside it, does require often some transportation. People want mobility. What is a successful transportation network in new urbanism?
Milwaukee is an older industrial city, so it had an existing streetcar grid. So now it's folding the streetcar back in. It's incorporating bike lanes. It's creating places where you have some people. And while there may be frustration now that you're not quite getting to that end point, think of it now not as an end point, but as a step in the evolution. Every single city that has begun its transformation to return to its vibrant, prosperous downtown, where it had been perhaps in the 1920s, 1930s, et cetera, has gone through this process where at some point it's not quite where it wants to be. So what are the benchmarks? The benchmarks are that you have a range of different transportation choices on how to get around. In some places, that absolutely is public transit. In other places, it's not. It can be a bike lane. It can be walking. It can be, you know, buses. It can be bus rapid transit. So again, thinking about how you build a foundation and then build off of that foundation. And so we talk a lot about the first mile, last mile, particularly in cities where Milwaukee is now, where it's an emerging transportation network. How can you get to the end of the line or to get to your different stops? So thinking about how you can use the land use, how you can increase density around those streetcar stops, how you can facilitate a range of choices, either through scooters, bikes, Uber, Lyft, will autonomous vehicles start doing a mile or 2 mile kind of circle around? But it's all about leveraging that first mile, last mile to feed into the transportation system. And then the transportation system will grow, then the land uses around it will grow, and then you're going to have a problem with affordable housing, and that these areas are only for a certain socioeconomic demographic. So I encourage Milwaukee now, or any city that is working to start this transformation or is in the initial steps, to ensure that access to transit, access to this emerging network, is accessible to those residents on the lower socioeconomic demographic.
On transportation, we still do have freeways. One has come down, Park East Freeway, but we still have freeways, Interstate 94, Interstate 43, and there are plenty of people that come in and drive out or drive out and come back in. Do people in cars have anything to fear from new urbanism, or should they embrace it?
Well, what I like to say, I get this question a lot, and what I like to say is I have a car, I drive my car, I also have 3 bikes, and I love the fact that I have multiple choices on how to get to work. Sometimes I do take my car because I need to bring in a load of things. Most of the times I like to bike, mostly for the public health outcome, my own personal public health, right? But we are designing places for people, and as part of that, there is room for cars in the equation. At the same time, I do not believe that cars have the right or that cities have the responsibility to build places that are dominated by cars. There is a distinct difference between building a city, and there's a number of cities that are dominated by their surface level parking lot that is dominated by cars, versus Copenhagen, for example, or Amsterdam. Those are two extreme choices of how they made the transformation from a place dominated by cars to a place dominated by pedestrians. Most of the cities in the United States, with a few exceptions of, say, New York City and maybe downtown Boston, San Francisco, are places that are still too much dominated by cars, that the political officials are too nervous to say, well, we need to create robust choices. You know, people from the outer areas need to be able to come in. Well, let's start with designing places and have that unit of measurement, the person first, the people, the residents, both the legacy residents and the folks coming in. How can we make cars part of the equation but not the dominant part? And I think that's the challenge for the 21st century. In so many ways, we are still looking at designing our cities in a very 20th century perspective, post-World War II, where we need to get into a point where we're thinking about housing configurations that respond to the demographics of the 21st century family. We need to look at how we're designing our neighborhoods that that best respond to 21st century concerns. We need to move our cities into the next century. And that's what's so exciting about this work now, is that we're at that point. New urbanism, smart growth, sustainable urbanism, city building, placemaking, these are all principles that are very, very similar, and cities have embraced it. So what's next? How now can we design our cities and neighborhoods and places to help with the food production, to help mitigate and adapt to our changing climate, to help ensure that legacy residents still have greater access to the opportunities that are coming into the revitalization effort? These are all the questions of the 21st century.
As to legacy residents in Milwaukee, I think you would say a lot of them are poor, are in poverty, in parts of the city anyway. How do we make a community more walkable, livable, and not displace people that have been there for generations?
I loved how you framed that question, because it wasn't an either or, like we have to stop gentrification. These areas need investment. They need desperate investment. So the question becomes, how can we invest in our communities that have seen decades of disinvestment and do it in a way that minimizes displacement and ensures that the legacy residents have equal access to the opportunity and to the wealth that is created within these communities? And I think, to be honest, we don't have a lot of answers. We do know some strategies. We do know that it's not about coming in the top down, that it's about working collaboratively with the talent. Every single one of those communities has incredible talent. Every single one of those communities has residents that want to make their place better. So how can you identify those residents and work collaboratively? I don't mean collaboratively in the way that we've used it in the past, but as a true 50-50 partnership, where if you're coming in as an outsider, you're bringing a certain amount of technical skill, but you're working hand in hand alongside with those folks in the neighborhood that want to make it a better place. There are a handful of examples of where this has happened successfully. Our organization just released a report that tries to highlight some of these examples, called Building Local Strength: Emerging Strategies for Inclusive Development. And I'll also tell you, there are more questions than we have answers. While we have a few emerging strategies, I do believe that there's room for about 100 more, and that's going to be the solution.
One of your projects is called Code Reform, or Project for Code Reform. What does that mean for a community like Milwaukee, other urban areas? What are you trying to reform?
Your local codes and ordinances are the DNA of any community. They're what guides the redevelopment efforts as well as creating new communities. And many of these codes haven't been updated either from the 1920s or post-World War II. You know, they're decades, like 3, 4, 5 decades out of date. The process of updating those codes and ordinances can be incredibly expensive, incredibly time-consuming, and take enormous amounts of political will. So what happens if you turn that equation on the side and to say, if you do nothing else, do this one thing?
Presumably, some of these codes, though, came along for fire safety, for consistency, for not putting a belching factory next to a neighborhood or vice versa. How do you determine which codes need reform?
That's a great question, because it gets to the intent behind the codes. Nobody was trying to set up a system that had unintended consequences of institutionalizing racism, institutionalizing segregation. These were not, or I like to give the original code writers the benefit of the doubt, the original intent, but these were some of the unintended consequences. So you look at the bigger picture and you try to determine what you're trying to solve for. So if you are a mayor or a city council of a small town of 25,000 and you're trying to bring your main street back, which is dominated by surface parking lots, well, then the first thing you might want to look at is your parking. Do you require on-street parking? If not, you should, right? Can you modify how much parking is required for a new development if you have on-street parking? So thinking creatively about, in your downtown area, which might just be 4 blocks by 2 blocks, how can you modify the parking for that that area, which is going to be very different from your residential area, what your parking requirements are. So it goes to, when you asked, how can we best determine, or how can a city government determine what codes to fix, you start with, what do you hope to achieve, and what's the biggest barrier that's preventing you from getting to that vision? And that's the code that you begin to modify.
Looking ahead 10, 20 years from now, my final question, what do you envision for communities like Milwaukee? How will they be different?
Oh, that's a great question. And you know, you put a time frame out of 10 years and you think, oh, 10 years is so far away. And I hate to tell you, it's like right around the corner. I do want to put out a vision. Maybe it will be in 10 years, maybe it will be in 50 years, but maybe it will be in 75 years. And I think that what we will find is that we will have fewer streets that are dedicated solely to cars, that we will have a lane that is dedicated for the kind of motorized single transport that we have now, whether it is scooters, e-bikes, or bikes, right? Right now, it's sharing kind of 3 feet with cars or on the sidewalk. Let's give it their own lane. I think that we're going to see all of our older buildings. Milwaukee has such great older buildings. They're going to be transformed into housing. Existing surface parking lots are going to be transformed into different kinds of activity spaces, and that may include tiny homes for kind of transitional housing for teachers or for homeless or whatever. But how can we think about all of the space we have in ways that meet multiple community outcomes, that our streets and roads really will become community space and an active public realm, where walking is not just, oh, you walk to work, you biked, and that's a little bit unusual, but it becomes the norm. And it's the norm because it is how we began to address the public health crisis, which is now gripping America. That the issue becomes less about, no, I want to keep my house on 5 acres of, really? What are you doing with that 5 acres? How are you contributing to the community in terms of, you know, food production or climate? How can we use our space in a more kind of collaborative way that meets, again, multiple community goals? I firmly believe that 50, 75, 100 years from now, there will still be single-family detached homes, but I don't think it will be the dominant housing type anymore. I think we're going to see a real upsurge in the way that we used to build with missing middle housing. Something will look like a single family detached home, but it will be, you know, a four unit, it will be a triplex, four square, it will be a duplex. We're going to adjust the type of housing that we're building to adjust to the demographics and how we're changing as a population. And then finally, we will shift to having cars to a conversation about increasing our mobility. Period. Right now, the conversation is cars or not, when the conversation needs to be around transportation fluency. It needs to be around mobility. We want to establish a system of how you can get from point A to point B in the most efficient way possible. Right now, it's about cars, but let's turn it on the side and make it about mobility. And that's where I feel we'll be going.
Lynn Richards is the president and CEO of the Congress for the New Urbanism. She was in Milwaukee recently and spoke with WUWM's innovation reporter, Chuck Kornbach. There's more information about Lynn Richards and the Congress for the New Urbanism at WUWM.com. Coming up after a short break, we'll take a look at the USDA's proposed changes to the federal nutrition program known as SNAP and what it could mean for families in Wisconsin. You are listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. It's great to have you with us. More than 300,000 households in Wisconsin depend on federal programs for food. The programs go by many names, including food stamps, SNAP, and food share, but they all translate to one thing, hunger relief. Now, 25,000 households in the state are at risk of losing some of those benefits. The USDA, which runs the program, is proposing removing a so-called loophole that makes it easier for families to access these programs. Sherry Tussler is the executive director of the Hunger Task Force here in Milwaukee, which operates a food bank and works to prevent malnutrition and hunger. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers and started by describing how the SNAP program operates.
The SNAP benefits are food buying power that you get in a debit card if you are income eligible. And so you have to prove through the application process what your income is, what your expenses are, your household size, and anything in the application you might answer yes to has to be proven.
So who here in Wisconsin is eligible for these benefits?
People who are living at or below 130% of the poverty line. So very low income people, seniors living in public housing, people with disabilities, working poor people, people making the minimum wage who are working either full or part-time are likely to be eligible for SNAP, working families, and so lots of families with young children are using the SNAP program.
So we're looking right now at some changes that the USDA is proposing to the SNAP program. What are those changes?
They want to change or eliminate what they consider to be a loophole called categorical eligibility. And that rule basically says that if you're eligible for one federal nutrition assistance program because you reach that benchmark of poverty, you may be eligible for another one. And so it reduces the verification process, the application, where you have to say yes if you have certain kinds of income or you have expenses. You will not have to verify your eligibility at the same level. And so recently there was a gentleman, I believe from Minnesota, who to make a point applied for SNAP and got the benefit. And he apparently had a lot of assets and they didn't review his assets but granted him eligibility. And so he made this announcement, look at me, I'm a millionaire. I'm on SNAP, which means all kinds of millionaires are on SNAP. Which isn't true. He committed program fraud, and he probably should go to jail and be forced into repayment, which would be a SNAP rule. So the Trump administration is now looking at closing what they consider to be a loophole where he didn't have to have all of his assets checked to make sure that seniors living in public housing are also not millionaires.
How common is this kind of fraud?
Well, fraud takes a couple of different shapes. It could be program fraud where you intentionally misinform the government and you're at risk of not only repayment but possibly going to jail. Fraud can also take place at a grocery store level where a grocer might accept your food share in exchange for things that aren't eligible to be purchased. Fraud can also happen inside the welfare office when two or more workers collude and steal food share benefits.
So the kind of fraud that it seems like these new rules are addressing are people who are willfully and deliberately defrauding the government.
It would sound as if that's the intent of closing the loophole, but in reality, about 25,000 households in Wisconsin would then be at risk of losing their SNAP benefits. And so it doesn't make sense to take action to close categorical eligibility in order to prove that one millionaire committed fraud while harming 25,000 eligible families who really need the assistance.
And that's 25,000 people here in Wisconsin, but it's a few million people throughout the country.
3.1 million people might be impacted by this proposed change with the administration. And it's important to say that Congress, on a bipartisan basis, rejected eliminating this loophole categorical eligibility with the 2018 Farm Bill. So we're revisiting something we've already visited. And the benefit, frankly, to categorical eligibility is it allows people to have a minor amount in savings. It allows children to qualify equally for school meals programs, like the National School Lunch Program and school breakfast. And so when we eliminate it, we may automatically eliminate families from getting school meals, even though their children are eligible for them.
Well, and specifically families that seem like they really need it.
Lots of families do. 130% of poverty is not a lot to live on. The average benefit in the state of Wisconsin is $110 per month. And seniors and people with disabilities living in public housing get $15 per month in food buying power. So to me, working in the hunger relief field, it seems like a lot to do about nothing. The SNAP program's been in place for decades. It has very intensive application requirements. To renew your benefits after 6 months, you have to reprove everything you've already proved. It's not a program that's taken lightly.
Well, in Wisconsin has made a number of different changes, I know, over the last decade to the SNAP program, which seems like it's really decreased the number of people who are eligible for the program.
Yes. Under the Walker administration, we voluntarily lifted a waiver that was in place due to the recession that didn't require people on SNAP to look for work actively. And so when we withdrew that waiver, we agreed that we would make people work and prove it for at least 80 hours per month in order to remain eligible for SNAP past a 90-day window. And what happened was 100,000 households lost their SNAP. The complicated story behind it is that the work requirements were almost impossible to prove because we hired a for-profit company here in Milwaukee. And we challenged SNAP recipients to prove to that for-profit company that they were either working or searching for work at least 80 hours per month in order to maintain their benefits. And that for-profit company did a really, really crummy job of addressing both work requirements and processing paperwork. And people just had their cases closed. And people, when they got their cases closed, it was closed for 3 years.
So they weren't able to reapply, they had to wait for 3 years?
Yes. In some cases, homeless people lost their benefits because they couldn't prove that they were homeless.
Well, and that's a question that I have listening to all of this. You know, if you're somebody who is homeless, who maybe has mental health problems, who has a myriad of things that might complicate your access to paperwork specifically, how do you prove some of these things? How do you prove that you're looking for work?
Right. How do you prove that you don't work at a fast food restaurant anymore? I mean, professional people, if we get a pink slip, we get a letter that says you don't work here anymore. But if you don't work at McDonald's anymore, nobody's going to write you a note on a napkin proving that you don't work there. And the requirements are so intense that the worker at the welfare office has to look at employer reports, and they're looking at the last quarter. And so they see that you were still at McDonald's last quarter, and so then they challenge you to prove that you no longer work at McDonald's. How do you prove that you're homeless? If people aren't paying attention, they might notice the giant tent encampment of homeless people going on down by 6th and Clybourne, growing bigger by the day. All of those people are eligible for food share. The question is, are any of them getting it? And did they lose their food share and as a result become homeless because they could no longer contribute to the household?
How do the proposed changes exist in the context of the greater changes that the Trump administration has been seeking overall to the SNAP program?
The Trump administration hasn't paid a lot of attention to the SNAP program, but it has recently started infusing resources into another federal nutrition program called the Emergency Food Assistance Program through the Trade Mitigation Program. And so food banks across the U.S. are receiving more food than they ever have before, but it's part of the bailout that we created when we created the trade war. And so we receive commodity foods in food banks, soup kitchens, homeless shelters, and food pantries because they're in excess, because we haven't sold them. And so those foods go to charity. The Trump administration declared a year ago that there was unjust action against farmers, U.S. farmers, when the trade wars were initiated, and they used that program to bail out the farmers and agribusiness to the tune of $12 billion worth of food, which is now everywhere in the charitable network. But at the same time that we're pushing that food down to charities, we're stripping the most reliable program of all, SNAP, of everything that it has, and we're harming people. We're pushing people further into dependency. And while charity may be the answer sometimes, it is not the answer every day for your food.
Well, and it seems like, you know, the Hunger Task Force is the largest network of its kind in the state of Wisconsin, but you're not really set up to be feeding everyone who's on the SNAP program.
That is very true. So if we've got locally 170,000 to 200,000 households relying on SNAP, Hunger Task Force will feed between 20 and 40,000 of those households with charitable food. So if SNAP were to disappear, it would break the back of the charitable network that's well established here in Milwaukee. It would do harm across the state of Wisconsin.
So we're already looking at a landscape inside of Wisconsin where a lot of people have been taken off the SNAP benefits over the last decade. What happens when people aren't getting these benefits? Where do they go?
Food pantries, soup kitchens, homeless shelters. Mostly when you first run out of food, you'll depend upon your family and friends. And so you won't really go to apply for that food share or SNAP benefit until you really are hitting rock bottom. And on that day, you should be eligible as what they would call an expedited service. And so you should be able to get your benefits in 7 or fewer days if you report you have little or no money for food. But the answer isn't charity. And we came to recognize that when the government shut down back in January. The entire Hunger Task Force budget, which supports all the food pantries, soup kitchens, and homeless shelters here in Milwaukee, it's about $16 million. A single month of SNAP benefits was twice that. That's a year of $16 million, a single month, twice that. And so SNAP is a critical part of our local economy. It keeps the grocery store industry in business, the transportation industry and business. It employs lots of people. There's a huge benefit to the SNAP program on an economic level. And when we talk about reducing SNAP benefits, we're not only creating hunger in a state that produces food that feeds many, many other nations. It doesn't make any sense. Why would a kid in the city of Milwaukee experience hunger, 1 in 4 children, on a chronic level when there's so much food that we produce here? And we have these federal nutrition assistance programs, but they can't reach the people.
Yeah. Well, Sherry, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Glad to be here.
Sherry Tussler is the executive director of the Hunger Task Force based in Milwaukee. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. Our interview with her first aired in July. However, today is the final day for public input on the proposed changes to the SNAP program. There's a link to more information where you can weigh in at WUWM.com. We'll take one last break, and then Doors Open Milwaukee comes your way this weekend. More than 170 buildings will be open to the public, but the spotlight this year is on the Near West Side. We will learn more when Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. We are back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. This weekend, more than 170 buildings in Milwaukee not normally open to the public will be. Doors Open Milwaukee is a citywide event that's put on by Historic Milwaukee, Inc. That's a nonprofit group working to increase public awareness of Milwaukee's history and significant architecture. Last year, more than 31,000 people explored buildings and sites all over Metro Milwaukee. Doors Open Milwaukee 2019 also takes place across the city, but this year's featured neighborhood is the Near West Side. I'm joined in the studio by the executive director of the Near West Side Partners, Keith Stanley, and by Historic Milwaukee's events director, Grace Fuhr. Grace and Keith, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Doors Open Milwaukee, how many years now, Grace, has this been going on?
This will be our 9th annual Doors Open.
And so this time it's focused on the Near West Side, and I want to find out what it is about that part of town. What was it historically, architecturally, that makes this such a compelling place to focus Doors Open?
Well, Bonnie, I was driving today to this appointment to be on the air, and I was driving down Wisconsin Avenue, and I saw the sun, you know, gleaming on these beautiful historic architecture that we have along Wisconsin Avenue. And this is all west of I-43, so not even downtown. And I just thought, if you took away this slice of the city of Milwaukee, you take away a significant chunk of what Milwaukee is, from the beer barons who line the formerly Grand Avenue, now Wisconsin Avenue. You take away Milwaukee. If you take away the Triple I Shrine Center, that would probably take billions of dollars, if not trillions, to be replaced. You take away a slice of Milwaukee. You take away some of my historic buildings like the Rave, Eagles Club, the Ambassador Hotel. I think Milwaukee is not the city of what it is today without the Near West Side and the beautiful architecture that lines Wisconsin, State Street, Wells, Clybourne. And so we're glad to be a part of this Doors Open, be a featured neighborhood.
One of the things I find so interesting about that part of town is that it's an area of extremes. Like you mentioned the Beer Barons, you know, you've got the Pabst Mansion, you've got the Triple I Shrine, you've got all of that. And then you've got things like the Ambassador Hotel, which was part of the Green Book, where African Americans could come and be safe and stay in a
safe place.
And so you've got very much working class, you've got a racial interesting mix there, and you've got extreme wealth, all in this part of town.
The Near West Side, and we're proud to state that we our population, our demographic reflects that of the city, probably being really diverse, 38% African American, 35% white, and a growing number of other, our Hispanic brothers and sisters, our Hmong brothers and sisters, Burmese, it is growing. And so we're excited to be a part of that. And I will go back to Bonnie, what you said. You said something that was really valuable. My work in the Near West Side for the past 15 years, we've talked a lot about extremes in this country now and inequality. What was really cool, I think, about the Near West Side as it was growing pre-turn of the century and pre-1900s and then into the 1900s was that the workers who worked on the manufacture of the Harley-Davidsons, who brewed the beer, they were blocks away from the beer barons. They saw the wealth and they saw what they could become and what they could do if they worked hard in this and that environment. And to me, it's fascinating that we're that stretch of neighborhood brought so many people together, and you're rubbing elbows with all type of people. So you could see the Captain Pabst as he hopped on his carriage or whatever to go manage the company. That's quite fascinating to me that we had that mix of population within the community, and still look at that today.
So, Grace, as far as Historic Milwaukee is concerned, is this the first time you focused on this neighborhood?
This is. For Doors Open, we've never focused on the Near West Side before. We just started doing spotlight neighborhoods as part of Doors Open in 2016, and each year we choose a different neighborhood. And a lot of what motivates the spotlight neighborhoods is a very strong commercial corridor and buildings that people would be able to tour throughout the event. So clearly, Wisconsin Avenue is a really great commercial corridor. Last year, we were on Mitchell Street and King Drive, but we just were very excited to work with Keith, and we actually met with him 2 years ago to talk about this as a possibility, and Wisconsin Avenue was under construction at the time. So now that that is all beautifully reconstructed, it's a really great time to be in the neighborhood and featuring it there. We have in the past done Spaces and Traces, which is our residential tour in the Concordia neighborhood, and we've had other special events with homeowners in that area, more focusing on the residential side. So it's been exciting to get to know more of the commercial side of the neighborhood, because there's a very strong business corridor, I would say, but there's also a very strong residential groups in those neighborhoods.
Well, Keith, like you were saying, people lived right near where they were working this neighborhood came up.
That's correct. And so you have neighborhoods like Merrill Park, where you had Henry Meyer actually living in the neighborhood. You had neighborhoods historic Concordia, which had the college, Concordia University, there with the professors living right in the community. So there you have this mix of these multi-units, but along with these beautiful, large Queen Anne Victorian homes where people, once again, you live there, you work there, at one point, 7 hospitals. So very vibrant community with a mix of people.
What is the geographic boundary of the Near West Side?
On the east, it's I-43. So we have a portion of what formerly was the Torrey Hill, the former Italian community. So east is I-43, west is 175, south is I-94, and then north is, depending if you're west of 27th Street, it's Vilete. If you're east of 27th Street, it's Highland. And so that's pretty much how it was for the past 80 years for the city of Milwaukee. And so when the Near West Side Partners came about in 2014, we pretty much kept those original boundaries, keeping with the 7 historic neighborhoods within the Near West Side.
So when your organization did come into being, what was the purpose behind that? Was it to develop, redevelop, you know, save buildings from being torn down, all of those things?
I would assume Grace would appreciate this. It's two sides of the coin, sustain and revitalize. I think that the Near West Side Partners, along with our 28,000 residents and 370-plus businesses, realize that we inherently take away the fabric of the Near West Side if we remove, if we are intent upon removing some of the architecture, most of the architecture. So we want to sustain what we have there, sustain the beautiful community, sustain the people who live there, the homeowners, the renters, who all make Near West Side what it is, but also then revitalize our commercial corridors, revitalize the spirit of entrepreneurship in the Near West Side. So I mentioned some of the beer barons. So we had Harley Davidson, we had Miller Coors, we had a number of entrepreneurial businesses that came out of the Near West Side that were hoping to revitalize and bring more entrepreneurs into the community. So it's two-sided, sustain and revitalize, keeping in mind that that architecture really makes us who we are.
So, Grace, when people take the tour and they go on Doors Open this coming weekend, what do you think they're going to be most surprised by if they don't already live in the neighborhood?
I think that they'll be surprised by, as Keith was just saying, some of the really incredible architecture, but also some really neat community stories. So one that is a little bit lesser known is the Hands in Harmony Piano Studio, which is located on 33rd and Highland, and it's in a historic Eschweiler-designed mansion. It's right across the street from where some Harley Davidsons lived historically. They focus on teaching over 200 kids how to play piano, so it's a really great mission. And at their building during Doors Open, you'll be able to kind of learn how to play piano and also do some art-led activities with artists working in education in their back lot there. So I think that's a really neat story that people will be able to learn about. Another one, if people haven't already visited the Evicted exhibit at the Tower Theater and Mobile Design Box, that is located on 27th and Wells. And that building itself is really fascinating. It was built in 1926 as a movie theater by the same architect that built the Oriental. So people can peek their head in the theater. And then they can also see the National Building Museum built an Evicted display, which is based on Matthew Desmond's book, Evicted. So people, for the last weekend of September, they'll be able to see that on display, and that's a really moving exhibit. Central Standard Craft Distillery is one that I'm very excited about. People probably know the name from their Walker's Point tasting house, but they actually have their 10,000-square-foot facility where they make all of their spirits and distill in the Near West Side. So people will have a rare opportunity to tour that building.
And is that a building that they reclaimed, that they revitalized?
Yes. As far as I know, it was historically a warehouse space that they have new manufacturing in. So there's a lot of history there, like the Milwaukee Academy of Chinese Language School is going to be part of it. That's was historically a hospital in the 1920s. But
one of the seven.
Milwaukee Emergency Hospital. Yeah. Yes, one of the seven.
Wow.
Yes. So that's a very historic building, but a newer story that you can learn about there. And something that's going to be going on at the Milwaukee Academy of Chinese Language and on Marquette's campus at the Haggerty Museum of Art is a couple of live dance performances happening throughout Doors Open. So we're kind of trying to bring more than just an opportunity to see these architectural spaces in the neighborhood, but also bringing alive the neighborhood with special performances.
And so, Keith, you know, it's going to be great getting people into the neighborhood. What do you hope is a long-term result of having folks walk around and experience a neighborhood that they might not have already?
Bonnie, I don't still need thunder from grace, but ultimately on the higher level of having doors open in the city of Milwaukee is having everyone have a greater appreciation for our buildings and for our architecture and for our history and, quite frankly, for our culture on who we are as a people. And that's reflected in our buildings. On more of the macro level, I think, for the Near West Side, we are hoping, as a part of our branding efforts, that we're able to get new faces in the door to see the Near West Side in a different light. There's so many good things happening. More businesses are coming to the Near West Side. More people are moving and living in the Near West Side. And we're seeing such an increase in the momentum of how people view this is just quite exciting to be a partner with a historic Milwaukee on bringing people to this neighborhood. Grace mentioned a number of different sites, including Central Standard Distillery, Hands in Harmony, and then, you know, I think about the Catholic Financial Life building with the swim pool at the top. I think that's Milwaukee's only rooftop swimming pool. I think about the Triple I Shrine Center, the Rave Eagles Club, and all of these beautiful buildings that once people get inside, like, wow, I didn't know this was here. And that then hopefully plays into how people view the Near West Side. Maybe it's a place to live. Maybe it's a place to open up a business. Maybe it's a place to invest in. And so we're pretty excited to have that opportunity to showcase the Near West Side in a different light.
So, Grace, I know Doors Open is a chance, you know, for people to get out. Are you and the organization also hopeful that people come into these neighborhoods, whether it's the Near West Side or any of the other neighborhoods you've highlighted, and look at it with new eyes and as a possible, you know, new business, like Keith said, or maybe I'll move here, or this is a really wonderful place. I had no idea this restaurant was here.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's part of the reason why we started the Spotlight Neighborhood Program. The event is citywide, so there are, of course, sites throughout a lot of Milwaukee's neighborhoods. But we really hope that this is an opportunity for people to spend a lot of quality time there, not just throughout the Doors Open weekend, but that they come back and shop and visit a place that they didn't maybe have the opportunity to see during Doors Open. And that is one of the questions that we ask on a survey that we distribute throughout the weekend. So one question is, did you visit a neighborhood you were previously unfamiliar with? Do you plan on visiting that neighborhood again? And was your perception of the neighborhood increased as a result of the event? And we see really high numbers and results on that. So last year, 68% of attendees visited a neighborhood they were previously unfamiliar with, and 70% said that they would visit the neighborhood again outside of Doors Open to spend more time in that space.
Those are good numbers.
Yes. Yeah. We're very proud of that. And that is really one of the goals of Doors Open is one is to increase and foster appreciation of Milwaukee's history and architecture, which is our year-round mission as an organization, but really also to get people to explore neighborhoods and visit neighborhoods that they might not have the opportunity or think to visit otherwise.
Now, I know you're going to be very busy during the weekend, but do you have a particular place on the Near West Side that you are looking forward to going to see?
I have personally not seen the Evicted exhibit yet, so I plan on stopping by there. The Triple I Shrine is always a favorite. They have incredible architecture on the interior, and it's one of those buildings that you drive past on a weekly basis and might not be able to go in otherwise. So those are two that I look forward to seeing.
And Keith, I know you live there and are part of the partners, but is there something you're particularly looking forward to stepping inside?
Well, two items I would share, Bonnie. One is that I always love going to Central Standard Distillery. Shout out to the team over there. It's almost the way the vines grow on the windows and where the sun shines through is almost like a cathedral, and I just love spending time in there. The big brass distillery is just a really cool space. So I don't drink, but I love just being a hangout in that space. It's just a really cool, funky space. So I definitely want to visit that. And I will say that, Bonnie, we are working with our New Westside Partners team. We have been put together a bingo card, and we're hoping that people can, if you go visit a site, you get a sticker. And if you get so many stickers, you get a gift certificate from one of our local businesses. We invested some funds in being able to make sure all our small businesses, because we believe in small businesses, get an opportunity to be a part of this. And so we call it the September Guide to the Near West Side. And that weekend, if you visit six or more sites, you get, I think it's a $5 gift certificate. And if you go above that, you get a chance to win a gift package that includes hotel stays, Harley-Davidson swag, Marquette University swag. So we put together a nice package. So we encourage people to visit the website or pick up that card, because we're encouraging people to go visit as many sites as they can. And they're pretty popular. I see III gets a lot of people action.
Well, it's going to be a fabulous weekend. Doors Open is always a great weekend in Milwaukee. And let's hope for good weather. Well, you know, put that vibe out there that it's good weather. And I want to thank both of you, Grace and Keith, for coming in and sharing a little bit about this year's Spotlight.
Thank you for having us, Bonnie.
Thank you.
Keith Stanley is the executive director of the Near West Side Partners, and Grace Fuhrer is the events director for Historic Milwaukee. Doors Open Milwaukee 2019 takes place this weekend at over 170 sites across the city. There is a link to a map and more information about the weekend's event at wuwm.com. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North. We'll be back again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.